From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the amazing properties of gravity. Here's what's happening. Oh, bitterly cold temperatures gripping much of the nation, testing the courage of even winter-wise northerners and delivering a shock to those accustomed to far milder weather in the South. The cold has been blamed now for at least 10 deaths, prompting officials to open warming centers in the deep South and triggering pleas from government officials to check on neighbors, especially those who are elderly, sick, or who live alone. Here in St. Louis, where the temperatures have dropped 30 degrees below normal, the mayor has warned it was dangerously cold. It sure is. Robert Felix, author of Not by Fire, But by Ice, believing we're in the beginning stages of an ice age. Robert, where's this cold coming from?
Oh, my gosh, George. It's just amazing, isn't it? Oh. You know, tonight we're looking at 1 to 3 inches of snow in northern Florida. We're looking at up to 5 inches of snow in southern Georgia. And you know, people there are prepared for this sort of thing. They're also looking at a swath from Lake City, Florida, up toward Jekyll Island, Georgia. They're looking at maybe as much as a half inch of ice on the roads. And, well, you've lived in cold country. You know what that can do to people with no snow tires or any way to handle it. But that's tonight. And then tomorrow we're looking at storm starting to race up the East Coast. They're calling it a snow bomb. It might be. They're looking at 3 to 4 inches of snow in New York City, up to a foot of snow in Connecticut and Boston and along the I-95 corridor, and then it's going to get worse. I mean, then it's going to be moving up into Maine and New Brunswick. They're looking at blizzards, and my gosh, it's just.
I know the heating and cooling people are going crazy these days out here in the Midwest, Robert. I mean, people's motors are burning out. They haven't stopped running.
Yeah, I heard that people were complaining to the electrical companies because of buzzing in the electric wires, and that's because there's so darn much electricity trying to keep up with.
Absolutely, and natural gas and stuff. We'll check in with you later, Robert. But, man, it is cold, and it is probably one of the coldest in 100 years. North Korea has announced that it will reopen cross-border communications with South Korea in a sign of some easing, some animosity between the rival nations. The North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, has ordered the border hotline to be reopened for talks later on Wednesday there. And also Kim Jong-un has ordered that his rocket scientists construct North Korea's biggest ballistic missile ever, and he reportedly plans to launch the record rocket on the regime's 70th anniversary in September. Well, that's not very smart. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, what's your take on all this? Is he trying to trick people or what?
Well, it's beyond that. I mean, he's trying to divide the peace-loving pacifists in South Korea, led by their president, Moon Jae-in. And it's a tactic, basically, to split off the South Koreans from the Americans. Because remember, George, the South Koreans have been appeasing, you know, the North Korean regime that, you know, was once heavily Chinese and Russian-controlled for, you know, the last 60 years, over 60 years, you know, since the end of the Korean War in 53. So what you're looking at right now is an overture also by Kim, who's very unctuous in trying to get a delegation of North Koreans to the Seoul Winter Olympics that are coming up on the 8th of February. So that's really what's at play here more than anything. But the South Koreans have been put on notice by Trump, essentially saying that appeasement is not an option, no matter what the consequences. I think the South Koreans would be perfectly content to live with a nuclear North Korea. The United States isn't content about it because the missiles, as it's been stated by their foreign minister, are going to be hitting the United States.
That's right. They're not going to be aimed at South Korea.
No, they're not. And so The circumstances are very different for the United States right now as a national security issue.
All right, John.
What the U.S. Is committed to under Trump is preventing Pyongyang from getting a nuclear-ready ICBM that can hit anywhere in the United States. And that's why all bets are off after the Seoul Winter Olympics on February 25th.
And this situation is far from over, to be sure. The mayor of New York City has announced new measures to prevent vehicle ramming terror attacks there. Starting later this month, the city will begin installing 1,500 new permanent barriers in Times Square and other public spaces. The metal stations are meant to address the threat of vehicle-borne terror attacks and to keep pedestrians safe so people don't ram vans and cars into them. The Trump administration has ramped up its support of the Iranian regime change, announcing that it will use Facebook and Twitter to communicate directly with the pro-democracy protesters there who have taken to the streets to demand freedom from Tehran's hardline rule. As a matter of fact, they've stormed a police station tonight, and there are reports of 13 deaths since all of this started. Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of course, a number of books, including Atomic Iran. Jerry, how did this all start all of a sudden?
Periodically, George, it happened. 2009, I'm sure many will recall, there was also an uprising that Ahmadinejad at that time put down very severely. That was when President Trump went to Cairo and gave a speech on experienced Islam in three continents and was reaching across to Islam. And the insurrection was put down severely in 2009. What I'm watching right now is today in Iran, the Bazigi, which are these thugs on motorcycles, black clad, many armed, or with you know, batons to hit people, and were unleashed in Iran by the regime. And that's really the enforcer. They're the thugs. And that's the first step to getting the Revolutionary Guard in against the protesters. What I'm concerned about is, like in 2009, we haven't yet seen the iron fist of the regime come down. And the question is whether or not the protesters, whether this freedom movement's going to be able to survive the violence of the regime when the mullahs and Ayatollah Khamenei tries to survive.
Well, you know, Jerry, I've got to tell you, the fact that there is an uprising there makes it feel like the Arab Spring this time in the wintertime, but it does seem to be growing, doesn't it?
This uprising may be harder to put down than 2009 because, again, it's been building, and I think the freedom movement is stronger and larger in Iran and across the country. I think it's going to be much harder for the regime to put this one down without making some major changes in how the country is governed. The people of Iran, I mean, everyone should be clear that the people of Iran who are protesting in the streets, these are the freedom fighters. These are the people who want freedom in their own country. I've worked with them in the United States since 2005. These are, you know, wonderful people. These are people who want freedom. And I'm praying daily that the protesters and the Iranians fighting for their freedom in the streets survive. And they've got great support here in the United States. There's a very large Iranian community in California, as you know, George.
That's right.
And they're extremely supportive of what's going on with this uprising. And so I'm watching it very carefully and hoping that we have a very different outcome than we did in 2009. Namely, I'm hoping the freedom fighters in the streets this time make a difference and get to change the regime.
If the Iranian Revolutionary Guard goes crazy and starts shooting these protesters, then what happens?
Well, usually what they try to do is they try to beat up the protesters first and really severely injure a number. And then they'll start arresting. People will start disappearing. I mean, the regime is watching very carefully to see who the organizers are, and they'll disappear and be put in prison and probably never heard of again. Regime could start hanging a number of protesters. I mean, it's a very, very violent regime. And the protesters now are going to have to go through a phase of continuing to protest despite the regime out there with brute force, the mullahs trying to survive. And the next 48 hours, I think, George, are going to be very important in determining whether or not this freedom movement can survive.
You got it. Jerry Corsi writes for Infowars.com, by the way, part of Alex Jones's group of companies. A Florida man has been arrested following accusations by prosecutors that he murdered his stepson, then forced the child's siblings to sleep in the same bed with the dead boy. Jeez. Although their goal was to cure diabetes, scientists may have stumbled onto a new medication to help treat the devastating effects of Alzheimer's disease. According to a news release from researchers at Lancaster University, a new drug being tested for diabetes patients was found to have significantly reversed memory loss in test subjects and is now being examined as possible treatment for Alzheimer's. Gaming addiction is listed as a mental health condition now for the first time by the World Health Organization. It's the 11th international classification of diseases. It will include the condition gaming disorder. Up next, new examples of forbidden archaeology. Michael Cremo joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Michael Cremo with us for the next couple hours. Michael, of course, is known as the forbidden archaeologist, hailed as a groundbreaking research pioneer and international authority on the archaeological anomalies. Michael continues to dig up discoveries in the fossil record and shake up accepted paradigms. He's got a number of books out, including Human Devolution, Forbidden Archaeology, and The Forbidden Archaeologist, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Always a pleasure, Michael. How are you? How were the holidays for you?
Oh, they were really great, George. Good to be with you again and all your listeners.
You too, my friend. We're constantly looking at new stories about past civilizations, either discoveries or changes. What have you uncovered these days, Michael?
Well, 2017 was a really interesting year. There were some amazing discoveries that were made by archaeologists who really didn't understand what they were finding, really. For example, in 2017, some archaeologists working in Crete, which is that big Greek island in the Mediterranean Sea, the Aegean Sea, they found footprints in layers of rock 5,700,000 years old. And I studied their scientific reports very carefully. You know, they say that the footprints display many of the features of the anatomically modern human foot. They have a big toe like ours. Apes and monkeys, they also have a big toe or a first toe, but it sort of moves out to the side like a human thumb. You know, you can put your thumb at a 90-degree angle to the rest of your fingers. So a lot of apes and monkeys, you know, they have a foot like that, sort of like a human hand. But this foot structure was like that of an anatomically modern human being. There was a clear ball of the foot. The toes were the right length. There were no signs of anything other than it being like modern human footprints. But because they were found in layers of rock 5,700,000 years old, the discoverers did not interpret them as having been made by human beings like us. You know, they proposed, well, there must have been some kind of up to now unknown kind of ape man, sort of like some version of Australopithecus or one of those very primitive hominins, they're called, human-like ancestors that existed millions of years ago. So they said, well, these must have been made by some up to now unknown creature like that. But when I look at them and I look at their scientific descriptions of them and the photos of them, they're like anatomically modern human footprints. A little small, they're up to about 8 or 9 inches long, but that's the size of a regular person's foot.
And how tall do you think that might have been, Michael? 5'6" to 5'10", something like that?
Something like that. You know, some of them might have been smaller. There were some smaller footprints, but they could have been those of juveniles, children. So, yeah, that was a pretty amazing discovery. And then they also had, you know, gradually they're making progress, I think. You know, what I talk about in my work is evidence for extreme human antiquity. When I first published my book, Forbidden Archaeology, in 1993, most scientists thought the oldest humans like us went back about 100,000 years.
Right.
And then 10 years later, they had pushed it back to 200,000 years. And last year, they found in Morocco at a site there, a cave, it's called the Jebel Irhoud cave. You know, they found some skulls that had anatomically modern human features that were about 300,000 years old. So gradually they're making progress. They're taking tiny steps in the right direction, I believe. But I believe they've got a long way to go before they arrive at a true appreciation of how truly ancient our anatomically modern human species really is.
They would be shocked, Michael, if they knew your dates, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, this is something that we find in a lot of ancient wisdom traditions. You know, my personal work is inspired by my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which talk of a very ancient human presence going back millions and millions and millions of years. But I've also been looking into some Buddhist texts. You know, they have the idea that the Buddha existed in previous ages.
Right.
Or human civilizations going back many kalpas. And it's interesting, in the Buddhist conception, a kalpa is a period of time. It's one of their time cycles that goes back millions and millions of years. The Buddha once said that if you had a mountain 16 miles high and 16 miles wide, and if you wiped it with a silk cloth once every 100 years, the amount of time that it would take to wear that mountain down at that rate would be the equivalent of a kalpa. And the ancient Vedic texts from India, they assign a time period in years of 4,320,000,000 years for a kalpa.
Wow.
So in one of the Buddhist texts, you know, it talks about a personality they call the Vipassi Buddha, who existed 91 kalpas ago. I mean, that'd be billions and billions of years. So it's quite different from the picture that we get from modern science in the textbooks of archaeology and anthropology.
Why is there such a difference, Michael, between modern science and what researchers like yourself come up with?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with their understanding of what a human being actually is. I would say what we are is we're each individual conscious cells that have come from some higher level of reality. And somehow or other, at the present moment, we're not fit to exist on that higher level of reality. So there has to be some kind of alternative reality where we can act out our desires to dominate and control and exploit others. because the ruling principle on that higher level of reality is loving, harmonious cooperation between all conscious beings.
Hold on for a second, Michael. We're at the break. I want to come back and also talk about these stone circles found in a cave in southern France. Already planning ahead for 2018, so circle your calendar. Those of you who live in the greater Los Angeles area, our first luncheon series of the year kicks off on February 13th with Dr. Sky as we talk about space. We're going to have a great time there. Simply send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. That's lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Include your phone number and they'll get right back to you. Again, that's Tuesday, Feb 13th in Los Angeles. Then Saturday, March 10th in Salt Lake City, Utah, our live stage show. And tickets are starting to sell. That's the Janae Wagner Theater. Full information at coasttocoastam.com and our carousel reel, so you can sign up and get your tickets that way. I want a sold-out auditorium there. Their box office number is 801-355-2787. Their website is artsaltlake.org. That's simple, but again, everything's at coasttocoastam.com. And then on April 21st at the Virginia G. Piper Theater in Scottsdale, Arizona, our other live stage show, we're going to be doing about 4 to 6 of them throughout the year all over the country. This one's in Scottsdale, April 21st. Again, information at coasttocoastam.com or call 480-499-8587 or go to Scottsdale Arts. Put that S in there, scottsdalearts.org. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Cremo with us. We'll take calls with Michael next hour, by the way. Those of you calling now, you can keep calling. That'll ensure that at least you'll get picked up. Michael, can you explain the difference for us, first of all, between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, modern humans?
Well, you know, I used to think there was quite a bit of difference between Neanderthals and modern humans. But as I've looked more and more deeply into the accumulating evidence, you know, I'm starting to see that maybe they're not as different as some archaeologists used to think. You know, there's basically two groups among the archaeologists, lumpers and splitters. The lumpers look at the common features between creatures and try to make as few species as possible to accommodate the skeletal evidence that they discover,
mm-hmm.
whereas the splitters try to look at differences and make lots of different species. And I think we've got something like that going on with the Neanderthals. Usually the way they try to distinguish them is to say, well, they've got these, if you look at their skulls, they've got these huge brow ridges, these arches of bone that go above the eye sockets, or sometimes a straight bar of bone that goes just over the eye sockets, and a very low forehead, and a kind of a big jaw. But actually, you know, there are living populations of humans in various parts of the world who have those features. And if on the basis of those kinds of features, you're going to call them a different species, that's, I don't think that's anything that we like to do, scientists today. I don't think they're very much in favor of that. So what it looks like to me is our anatomically modern human species is probably a little bit, it encompasses more variety than some scientists were prepared to accept in the 19th century and early 20th century. So I would say what we call Neanderthals, who lived 100 or 300,000 years ago, according to most scientists were another variety of human. And genetically, scientists have discovered that modern human populations have a certain amount of Neanderthal genes still in their genetic makeup.
Does that mean they bred with each other?
Apparently they did, and that's another, you know, there are different ways to define a species. One is that they don't interbreed with each other and produce fertile offspring. So apparently that's not the case with humans and Neanderthals. Apparently they did breed with each other, and there is genetic evidence for that.
Why are they gone now, Michael? Do they just breed themselves out of existence? What happened?
Well, you know, that takes us into a controversial topic, because there are a few scientists who believe they are still living. There are still living specimens of
really?
Various parts of the world. Of course, that takes you into the whole field of Sasquatch and Bigfoot and the Yeti and the Albus.
All right.
And creatures like that.
So are they saying that they think Bigfoot might be a Neanderthal?
There was a British anthropologist named Myra Shackley, and she wrote an interesting book some years ago arguing exactly that these reported sightings of ape-man-like creatures in various wilderness parts of the world may be living examples of Neanderthals. So that's a possibility.
So we can't rule that out, can we?
I don't think so, not on the basis of the kinds of evidence that have been reported for the existence of these creatures. So I think it's just a sign that if you really look at all of the evidence, the pattern that kind of emerges is one of coexistence of humans like us with various ape-man-like creatures and ancient apes and monkeys. I think it's true today. Today, humans like us coexist on this planet with apes and monkeys, and also, apparently, if the evidence for Sasquatch and Bigfoot is taken seriously, which I think it should be, even today we're coexisting with these creatures. We did in the very distant past as well.
That would be amazing, Michael, if they came up with that or any further proof and evidence that Bigfoot was here, which I believe, but the fact that it could be a Neanderthal, or what I always said when I was a little boy, the missing link. Is it possible?
Yeah. You know, by missing link, I personally don't accept that as being an evolutionary link. But, you know, if you've got creatures that are somewhat like apes and monkeys and creatures somewhat like humans, why can't there be some intermediate sort? You know, just like you have a big car, a little car, why can't there be a medium-sized car as part of the set? So, yeah, I think there are. You know, we really don't have a complete inventory of all the different kinds of human-like beings that there are, either on this planet or other planets in our solar system or galaxy or universe.
Tell me about your trip to India. What was that for?
I went to India in 2017. A couple of times for a couple of purposes. Once I went at the invitation of one of the government leaders there to speak at a conference that was held in India about the real purpose of human life. And I was explaining, you know, if we want to really be successful in our lives, we have to know who we are and where we are. If somebody doesn't know who he is and where he is, we call a person like that crazy, and we tend to avoid people like that. If you're walking down the street and you encounter someone who is obviously disoriented and doesn't appear to know where he is, I mean, if you don't know where you are, you really can't act appropriately. And if you don't know who you are, well, you've got amnesia and you've got a problem. So I was saying we should have a proper understanding of who we are and where we are. And today, I think from modern science, we're getting very bad answers to those questions. You know, they say we're just machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival in an accidental universe that just happened by chance. I think if those are the kinds of understandings we have about who we are and where we are, we're going to have the kind of world that we see around us now. If we had the idea that we're all beings of pure consciousness in a world that's been provided for us to develop that resource of consciousness cooperatively and in harmony with each other, we'd see a different kind of world.
Michael, while you were in India, did you come across any stories about the Vimanas?
Yes, I did. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by that whole topic. Vimanas are spacecraft and aircraft. And the ancient Sanskrit writings of India have accounts of these things that go back thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and even millions of years ago. There are very elaborate descriptions of them, and they match up, interestingly enough, with modern reports of UFO encounters. And just like, you know, we've been getting some revelations from the American government, which has again revealed that it's been studying this topic. You know, that came out in 2017. There was another disclosure about the government funding that was going on for that kind of research. But what I find interesting is that the observations that come from the modern UFO researchers match up with the descriptions that were given thousands of years ago in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. You know, for example, they have a description of a Vimana that was used to attack a city on Earth. And the description of it was that it would appear to be in many different places at once, which is very reminiscent of some of the descriptions of the modern UFO phenomena, where a UFO will appear to be many places at once. It'll be seen at one point to be a single object in the sky, and then suddenly it'll be in multiple places simultaneously. So modern observers have noticed that, and descriptions like that are found in these ancient Sanskrit writings. So that is always something that I'm eager to learn more and more about.
That's exciting. Now, where did they go? Where are they?
Well, a lot of people say they're still around. But I think about 5,000 years ago, something happened. You know, according to these ancient wisdom traditions, time goes in vast cycles. And at certain points in the cycles, it seems our Earth is more in contact with other parts of the cosmos. You know, if you look at the teachings of the ancient Egyptians or the Sumerians or the ancient Chinese people or the ancient people in India or the ancient Greeks or Romans even, they, if you look at their art and their literature and their philosophy and their cosmology, you'll see they were in touch with extraterrestrial beings or beings from higher dimensions of reality on a quite regular basis. But something happened a few thousand years ago, 5,000 years ago, where those links of communication and contact with these beings from other parts of the cosmos and other dimensions of reality seem to have been cut off to some extent. Not completely, but it doesn't seem to be happening as much as it did in the past.
Michael, do you think in the past there could have been, because I think it's highly possible, some kind of nuclear war from in ancients, but they had that kind of technology?
There are descriptions of the ancient, in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, of weapons called Brahmastras. And the effects of these weapons resembles to some extent what happens when a modern nuclear weapon is set off. Hopefully we're never going to see that, but apparently, this has happened not just recently in 1945 during World War II, but even long before that. You know, Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist who was in charge of the American program to develop the atomic bomb during World War II, was also a student of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And when the first atomic bomb was tested at Alamogordo in New Mexico in 1945, he was in the bunker there. And when this explosion went off, you know, he began reciting some verses from one of the ancient Sanskrit texts, the Bhagavad Gita, about how it was like millions of suns all together in one place. And, you know, there were descriptions of the force of this being very destructive, like the force of time, which gradually destroys all things. But this happened, this explosion of this weapon happens very intensely in a very short period of time. So he was speaking about those things, and he was asked, Robert Oppenheimer was asked, well, what was it like to be present when the first atomic bomb was set off? And he kind of corrected the reporter, saying the first in modern times.
Is that amazing?
So I think it really is.
I mean, that tells you everything about what you've been studying. If someone like Oppenheimer could believe that there was that kind of technology in the past, truly rewrites the history books, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And, you know, there are history books that speak about these things. They're called the Puranas. Those are the historical writings of ancient India. And they speak about such things as Vimanas and Brahmastras and things like that. But it was a different kind of technology. Our level of technology relies on the gross material elements. You know, if we want to build an airplane, we dig into the earth, we mine ores, we refine them into metals, we use the metals in factories to assemble airplanes and spacecraft. Their technology was based on more subtle principles that they had mastered through their processes of yoga and meditation and things like that.
All right, hold on, Michael. We're going to come back and talk more about this incredible stories and also take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.